In the studio, I have the pleasure of the company of Sally Hunter and also Hugh Barrett. Now, Sally is spokesperson for the Northwest Alliance, but basically spokesperson for...
Yeah, so Northwest Alliance is a broader group, and,
right.
and I'm also involved with People for the Plains.
That's good. Okay, so we... And, of course, the Northwest Alliance group and People for the Plains are completely against the harvesting of coal seam gas. Would I be right there?
Yeah, we act as an education for the community about coal and gas projects, but obviously there's a lot going on with gas at the moment.
Well, yes, I think it's been sort of put into the news. Maybe you might have to wonder why it's been put into the news at this moment, but anyhow, it has been. And, of course, there is some talk by the government that there's not enough gas available for use by us Australians.
Yeah, they've coined the term gas crisis, but as the manufacturing industry and others have pointed out, it's more like a price crisis. There's plenty of gas in Australia. BHP CEO has said that we've got enough gas here for at least 200 years for Australian needs, but the problem becomes the price, because at the moment it's all being exported.
All right, so what are you saying, that you don't want to have any more gas fields opened up?
No, what I'm saying is building a new gas field at Narrabri will not solve the price crisis. It will have no impact on the price at all, because this gas is currently being exported, and the price that they can receive on that export market is what's driving the market. Narrabri Gas Project will not impact the price.
If I could cut in there, Tony,
yep, right.
Australia is looking to become the world's largest exporter of gas by 2021. It's looking to exceed the gas exported by Qatar, currently the world's largest producer. So by 2021, Australia wants to export more than Qatar, most in the world. And yet we're told we're short of gas, that Australia needs the gas. Now, the media are obviously getting onto that now and realise that that is just a fabrication, that it was a deliberate policy by the gas companies to be able to export the gas so they could reach world parity price and charge Australians that price, which is the price crisis that Sally refers to. Every other gas-producing nation in the world has a gas reservation policy. So they all keep some gas for their domestic users. The domestic price of gas in the United States is only a fraction of what it is in Australia. There's plenty of gas here. We actually don't need the Narrabri Gas Project.
So it's okay to get the gas from somewhere else, but not necessarily from our area. Is that the way you look at it?
Well, no, I think we have a more holistic view than that. But we are really concerned about the impacts of the Narrabri Gas Project. We have some pretty unique assets here in terms of our water and the Great Artesian Basin and aquifers. And we just believe that the risks of those and others is far greater than the potential returns.
We will need to be phasing out gas in the future. We know that. We've committed the Paris Climate Accord. We have to reduce our fossil fuels, and methane is a very toxic greenhouse gas, so we will be decreasing it. In the meantime, of course, we recognise there's industries that are running on gas and that are dependent on gas, and they need a phase-out period, but we don't need gas wells, more gas wells, to achieve that.
And just on that too, to put it into perspective, the Gunnedah Basin, according to CSIRO, has only 4% of the nation's gas reserves. So, you know, it's a very small field compared to the others that are already operating.
Even with 850 holes.
Well, that's even beyond the 850 holes. That's the basin itself, which will include more gas reserves than just the 850 wells that are currently proposed. Santos is talking about up to 7 new gas fields across New South Wales, and they've already mapped those and promoted them to their investors. So that spreads, you know, from the Queensland border right down south and across to the Hunter Valley.
So your point is with the gas fields here in Narrabri that they're going to be detrimental to, one, the inhabitants, to the environment. And so what do you just suggest that, no, we don't do anything with it?
Yeah, I suggest that it's been there for millions of years and that's where it should remain. It's got elements within it that are not designed to be on the surface of the earth, and they need to remain where they are.
Now, we've heard of reports into it by the government scientists, etc., and yet they're going against that, or you people are going against that as such.
Yeah, again, it's the interpretation and the spin that we hear from the industry and from people that don't live in our area who come in and tell us how things are. And, the chief scientist report said that technically that things can be engineered in such a way to reduce the risks. But they also said that unintended consequences will end up happening simply because of human error.
And you must remember, Tony, the question that the chief scientist was asked, which was, how do we manage the risks, the uncertainties of CSG development, versus the question she wasn't asked, which was, should we have a CSG industry at all? She was never asked that question and never allowed to comment on it.
Right, okay. So actually, that's something you don't always hear about, isn't it? Actually, I've lost my train of thought.
That's all right, Tony. You've given us a perfect segue there about people for the planes. As you say, these are things you don't normally hear about. That is our role, is to educate people on the other side of the story and advocate. Because if you just go to the companies for your information on whether this is a good thing or not, well, it's a bit like going to Coca-Cola for dietary advice. You know, you're only going to get one side of the story, aren't you?
That's right. Don't do too much.
And unfortunately, our resources aren't the same as the industry resources to put behind these spin and these nice-looking graphics and whatnot. So Hugh and I come here today as volunteers. We put all this time into it simply because we are very concerned for the community of Narrabri and the people around Narrabri. So that's our pure motivation, nothing more, nothing less.
All right, so out there in the Pilliga Forest, they're suggesting that they may be able to dig 850 holes, for want of a better word. In other areas, they've done it. The Cooper Basin, I think, and over in Western Australia, they've done it, and there's been supposedly no damage done to anything that we know of.
Well, the Cooper Basin, of course, is what is known as conventional gas, where gas is trapped in the folds of the earth, and so it rises to the high points in those folds where it's trapped under impermeable rock, and so it sits there and has been tapped. We can argue whether it had done no damage at all. It's very remote, of course, so there's not too many people to get too upset, but if you look at the bigger picture, you know, it is a fossil fuel, and as I said, it's far more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So overall, yes, it has contributed to global warming. And whereas the gas at Narrabri, of course, is what we term unconventional gas, which is gas trapped in coal seams, coal and other fossil fuel, and the gas is trapped in there. And so unconventional techniques are used to extract that gas, and these are far more damaging than the conventional techniques, and that's why it's called unconventional gas.
So I was going to say, what are the unconventional ways of getting it out compared to something else other than drilling a hole? There's no fracking supposedly in this area?
Santos have said in their guidelines that they have no plans at this stage to frack. And that is only the Narrabri Gas Project, as Sally mentioned. It's one of seven target areas in the state. They have no plans to frack at Narrabri because the coal seam structure is set up so that the gas can be extracted simply by horizontal drilling. Now, horizontal drilling is an unconventional technique, but so it fits into that definition. It's getting gas from unconventional sources, not that like the Cooper Basin, which I described, but that which is in coal seams, which has to be stimulated in some way to get the gas to the surface. To get the gas to the surface, the water pressure in those coal seams, which are aquifers, the water pressure has to be dropped, so all that saline water has to come to the surface also, which is about half as salty as seawater. And then what are you going to do with that water? Well, it's proposed to be irrigated with, but what you've got, before you do that, you've got to take the salt out of it. What are you going to do with the salt? So unconventional gas brings a whole host of problems with it in addition to any of those you might have with conventional gas.
And I guess from my perspective, I was born and bred at Roma in Queensland, and so whilst it's a totally different situation to New South Wales in terms of the impacts that have happened, in Queensland they've set up a make good policy whereby if people's bores are impacted, the companies are obliged to make good. So, you know, firstly you sort of question, well, if there's a need for a make good policy, is it all wonderful? And secondly, along with that make good policy is a confidentiality clause. So it's very difficult to get people's stories out unless you're talking to them personally. But the Department of Natural Resources and Mines in Queensland last year released a study that said 459 bores would be affected over the next 5 years, and 91 of those would drop more than 5 metres, which is their trigger level. So I think those impacts are occurring. It's just a matter of getting that information out to people.
So the government's basically saying you don't say anything about it if you've got problems.
I'm not sure if it's the government saying it or it's the arrangements that companies have with individual landholders.
Okay. So we do have a problem as far as getting enough energy to either we use gas or we use coal. Now, they're closing down the Victorian stations that are using brown coal, which is more polluting than black coal. We're still using black coal, and I would assume will be what we use for the next 20 or 30 years. What's your thoughts on how we're going to bridge that, because it can't be done in 5 seconds. How are we going to have enough energy to power our electricity in the short term?
Current studies show that we can move totally to renewables within the next 10 years. You saw what Elon Musk proposed for South Australia in terms of batteries. You've also seen what the Prime Minister has proposed in terms of the snowy storage. Now, it's not too fanciful, actually, to think about it, that what he's proposing there is to spend $2 billion to get more pumped storage going in the snowy, plus $1.7 billion he didn't mention, which had been featured recently, the cost of actually moving that electricity to Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne. And I don't think it includes South Australia. Might be wrong there. But so we're talking the order of $4 billion to get this up and running to supply 500,000 homes. Now, if you do a bit of a back-of-the-envelope calculation, for $4 billion, I suspect if you went and talked to Elon Musk, you could probably get about 1 million battery packs for homes. So there is, within, you know, he said he could do South Australia in 100 days, there in a very short period of time is the capability of actually getting a lot of consumer demand off the grid. For example, if if it's the afternoon peak hour, industry's going flat out, everybody's turning on their air conditioners at home, well, if you've got battery backup, you can run that off that aircon off those batteries, and you don't have to spend the money on getting the transmission lines through to the capital cities. That's right there where the power is right there where it's needed, residing in every home.
Well, just a comment. I have solar, a small solar unit on my house, which I got at a very cheap rate, which was good. And I got a really top value back in when I generated more than I needed. Now I'm getting 6 cents or something. Why isn't the government looking at saying, righto, if I've got that on my roof now, and I'm sure that there were some subsidies by the government in those days, why aren't they giving me a better rate, which I don't care whether it pays for itself or not, but the fact that I'm using less electricity from the grid must be good. So why aren't they encouraging me to do that?
I think the primary reason is that the grid's not owned by the government, it's privatised, and so it's driven by returns. And so if you've got the combination of no political will to move towards a more sustainable future, combined with companies driven for profit, there's really no space to come up with innovative ways to address this issue. You know, it's a completely confected crisis that's been coming for 10 years. And, you know, for the government to be so surprised now is really quite a joke. And they've only been, it's only been the last, you know, couple of months where they've actually started to throw around a few ideas of good renewable solutions. But I don't think we've even, you know, touched the tip of the iceberg yet in terms of what the renewable solutions would be. But it's very scary for those companies that own the energy system, because ultimately we could well do them out of a job.
It's interesting how AGL and Origin are really talking up renewables and making a part of their future. They see the future's renewables. I know the writing's on the wall for gas. Yet Santos, when the Prime Minister had the meeting with those gas companies the other day, Santos was the only one that wouldn't give him a commitment. They're the only one, as far as I know, that don't have any commitment to renewables. Sorry, it's on their website that they have, but then they're the only ones I know aware of that are actually not doing anything and don't seem to want to do anything about it.
When it's all said and done, just going back to around about 1969 when I commenced working for the local electricity people, we were wholly and solely owned. The whole network right across Australia was owned by the government somewhere, or an authority by the government. Why did they change it? Even at the time, I said, why are you changing something that doesn't need changing?
Tony, you tell me.
It'd be so much easier if we still had it in the government's hand.
Absolutely.
I think the government still does have a role to play, though, and they really need to start showing some leadership towards that and getting the priorities right for Australia instead of this exporting everything overseas. It's ridiculous.
I think Jay Weatherill showed that the other day when he is taking back partial control and the Prime Minister, you know, putting more government resources into it. So I don't know whether there's an admission of a mistake there, but I think there might be a recognition of it.
Yes, I think it's about time somebody recognised that we shouldn't sell everything off.
Yeah.
And it's such a shame, you know, from a local perspective, that essentially the Narrabri community now has to pay for those mistakes made by governments and those big decisions made by companies. Mm. And now we're the meat in the sandwich that has to cough up for it, with our health and our agricultural industry suffering because of it.
Mm. All right, so we've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like to just mention briefly?
Might want to touch on something that I think is of concern to people in Narrabri, and it's a very reasonable concern. Narrabri struggles in its commercial centre, a lot of empty shop fronts. And so people say, well, where are the future? Where's the future for our children? You know, our kids need a future. Isn't this going to bring jobs? Sally, you've got some figures there on the sort of jobs we anticipate.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, this is not looked at from the community's best interests. It's used as a flag for promoting the industry, which is completely unhealthy. But essentially, the numbers have been bought out in the EIS. And so the construction phase, they've stated, will create 1,300 jobs. But if you look at it, they've said that 105 of these will be filled by Narrabri people.
And for 3 or 4 years.
And what's more, it's only a 3 to 4 year period for construction. So what I'm really interested in are long-term sustainable jobs that are going to be here longer than 3 or 4 years. So in that side, in the operational phase, there's talk of 45 jobs ongoing. So I look at that and I think 45 jobs created from this. You know, what's the solar farm at Moree? How many jobs is that creating? And what impacts is that having? So we need to weigh up the risks and the returns for our community.
And one of the things that is a particular concern, Tony, you know, as a Narrabri person, is what happens to the town after the construction phase. And I think if you look at Chinchilla in Queensland, it's a really good example to look at. And the mayor, sorry, no, the Chamber of Commerce president came down to Narrabri last year and talked to a forum at the Crossing Theatre, and he was very careful to be even-handed about the thing. He said, "Yeah, we did have a, you know, we made a lot of money when it was on, but now it's gone." And what happened while everyone was making a lot of money and everything, and people, the construction crews were moving in. House prices went absolutely through the roof. Rentals went absolutely through the roof. So the net result was that people, particularly older people, retired people, said, geez, I can get a good price for my house here. I'm going to retire and go to Toowoomba. So they did. They sold out. And then the workers moved out and the rental price collapsed. So you had this great overhang of building supply, house supply. And people then were left with these houses, couldn't sell them, couldn't get a decent rent for them. So the Queensland government solved that problem by moving a whole lot of people who were on welfare in Brisbane out to Chinchilla to they could get cheap housing, cheap rent, and they'd put them in Chinchilla. Now, that's fine, except the people who were the fabric of the town, the people who used to run the sports clubs, who used to run the charities, the volunteer people, they all retired and moved on. And what you have now is a lot of newcomers to the area who aren't used to taking on that role, who aren't aware of the things that need to be done. And so the sort of town dies from the inside out. So we really fear that, you know, we'd hate to see that happen to Narrabri. When people say they're really concerned for their future and they want to see that their children have a future here in Narrabri, you know, don't we all? But if we keep digging up gas and burning it, and we get to the sort of predictions, the predicted temperatures by the year 27 that, pardon me, the CSIRO predicts, you've got to say to yourself, well, what's Narrabri going to be like in 2070 if we keep doing this? Are we going to be like Walgett, or are we going to be like Bourke or Broken Hill? Well, researchers out at the Wheat Research Institute had a look at this, and there's nothing that's been published, well, apart from the local paper, but they had a look at it because they've got to breed wheat to cope with these conditions. And they found that the temperatures that Narrabri is expected to have in 2070 are those that are currently experienced in Oodnadatta. And if you don't know where Oodnadatta is, it's in the middle of the desert in South Australia. So I'm not saying that's a spot-on prediction, but it tells me right now we've got to do something about getting away from fossil fuels.
All right, just quickly, and we don't have much time left, what are our alternatives as far as... fossil fuel. Just quickly. Now we've got the big solar plant at Moree, and there's a possibility of one here in Narrabri, but of course they don't work at night.
The sun's usually shining somewhere in Australia, Tony, and we do
not
have
always.
Usually somewhere, and we do have transmission lines. And if it's not the sun's not shining, the wind will be blowing. But there's other things. Geothermal, there's wave energy.
I believe there's 64 different types of renewable energy.
And not one of them is a silver bullet. It's going to be, it's going to be a combination of these things, which but people will say, but it won't handle baseload power, which I was listening to an energy expert on the radio the other day, and the word baseload power just makes him cranky, because where it came from is that when we started developing major coal-fired power stations, particularly after the Second World War in places like Germany, you can't just turn a coal-fired power station on and off. So they were offering, if people would run their plants through the night and whatever, they would not have to turn, they could handle that if they could keep the demand up going through the night. So people use less in the day and more at night. Industry I'm talking about. And so they coined this term baseload for the minimum they could get the coal-fired power stations reasonably down to. But as he said, that we don't care where that energy comes from. It can come from wind, waves, solar, whatever. It can all be provided. All we're working on now is the batteries in the storage, the energy storage in the system, and the price of that is coming down so rapidly that that's the future.
Okay. One minute, and then I'll give you half a minute, and that'll be the end of it. We'll run out.
So, this is a huge issue. It covers a whole lot of different areas that affects different people differently. I just encourage everyone to have a think about how it impacts them personally and respond to the EIS that's currently out, the Environmental Impact Statement. If you want to know more about how to do that, we're having workshops all through the region in the next 2 weeks, and that's being advertised here on Max FM. And the Narrabri one is next Monday evening at 6 p.m, so I'd encourage you to come along and put in a submission to the EIS.
All right, and that closes in around about another 30 days or so, isn't it?
22nd of May it closes.
22nd of May, okay. All right, well, I'd like to just thank Sally Hunter and Hugh Barrett for your time this morning. Thank you very much. I hope it's been not entertaining, but educational for people who maybe don't have much of an idea of what's going on. But these things are going on, and if people are against this, please do something. Don't sit on your backside and do nothing. Do something about it if you're that way.
We appreciate your time today too, Anthony.
It's okay.
Thank you
very much.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. Yeah, that's been great.